Good morning. How's everybody doing? Good, good. All right, we're going to jump right into it, as is our custom. 2 Samuel chapter 11. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. Today we look at the story of David and Bathsheba, or maybe better, David and the wife of Uriah, the Hittite. And most of you know, we've been in a series on the life of King David, 6-week series. This is week 5. And I've been calling this series Faithfulness Through Adversity. And you look at David's life, you see a lot of adversity, and yet you see a faithfulness through it. And today we come to maybe the greatest adversity of all. It's not an external adversity like Goliath or Saul or armies out there. It's an internal adversity. It's the adversity of David's own sin that he has to wrestle with. And we're going to see this tragic story of what David does. And I think very relevant to us, I think, in the midst of an adverse time for many of you, economically, certainly, maybe relationally, maybe at home. There's a lot of adversity out there, and yet this is a great reminder that the greatest adversity, the greatest dangers are the ones in here. And we're going to see that from David. A lot of adversity, and yet we still see a faithfulness, even in this story, certainly a faithfulness of God to confront and forgive David, and then a faithfulness on David's part to repent and acknowledge his sin. So I'm going to read the story this morning. There's 2 chapters. I'm going to read basically 2 full chapters for you and make a couple comments along the way, and then we'll step back for the last 15 minutes and just draw out some lessons from this story. And I want to encourage you, I always want to encourage you this, but really try to get into this story. As tragic as this story is, it's great storytelling. The narrator is such a good storyteller, and there's so many little details that draw out some of the dynamics that are going on in the characters. Even though we never actually get to hear what they're thinking, there's all these cool little dynamics. So I really encourage you. I know it's a familiar story, but enter into this with me this morning. All right, so chapter 11. Again, I'm just going to read 2 chapters for you and make some comments along the way to try to draw out the story a little bit. All right, 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. So, the narrator starts with this very ominous beginning. In the time when kings are supposed to go out to war, hint, hint, David, as a king, you should be out fighting for your people right now. But of course, we see David instead back at the palace, removed from battle with way too much time and leisure on his hands. And it says he sent Joab to do the work that he should be doing. And you read this passage, David is always sending people in this passage to do the things that he wants them to do. And we'll certainly see that here. Verse 2, one evening David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. So David gets up at evening time, which is kind of interesting. You know, it would be common in that time to take a siesta, maybe after lunch. Siesta lasts till maybe 2 or 2:30. Apparently David's has lasted till about 6 at sundown. So he's been in bed way too long. And he gets up, and picture him on the roof. You know, the palace has a roof that you can walk out on, and it's above the city, so he can see over his city. So he gets up from this long siesta at evening time, goes out, and he's looking down at the town, and he sees this woman bathing, and scripture says she was very beautiful. Hebrew narrative is always very understated. So when Hebrew narrative tells you that someone is very beautiful, she is smoking hot, okay? She's hot, all right? She's as good as they come. And David is, of course, filled with desire, filled with passion for this woman. So he sends someone, which is his custom in this chapter. Verse 3, David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Let me tell you a little bit about Uriah. Later on in 2 Samuel, chapter 23, the narrator gives us a list of David's mighty men. And they're like these 30 guys who are his inner group, his inner core of warriors. These are his faithful, his elite troops who have fought with him, who would give their lives for him. They're his comrades in arm, basically, his 30 key guys. And guess who is the last guy on that list? Uriah, okay? So this is not some random guy in the kingdom. This is one of David's trusted comrades who has fought alongside him, who would give his life for David. And David knows this guy already. And you hear kind of a subtle, I think, a subtle warning in the servant's comment. He goes, isn't this Uriah's wife, David? Maybe, you know, David, are you sure you should be asking me this kind of question? Well, David is going to ignore this. Verse 4, then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Just three quick boom, boom, boom. You can just, it's like David's lust is just boom, boom, boom. Go, do it, done. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home. Verse 5, then David gets the bombshell here. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. And David is thinking, oh my gosh, what the heck have I just done? So, verse 6, so David sent this word to Joab out in the field. Send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. And of course, David's strategy is now going to be, oh my gosh, I've gotten this woman pregnant. I've got to bring her husband home so that he'll sleep with her so that he and everybody else in the kingdom will think this is his child and not my child. So I've got to cover up what I've done. So he's going to try a couple different strategies to do that. And of course, what's so painful is how much he tries to get this to happen and how faithful Uriah is to him throughout this process. This guy's just a righteous, faithful man, and that makes David's sin look that much worse. So let's look at David's attempts here. Verse 7, when Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. So David brings Uriah in and says, hey, buddy, you know, how's it going out there? And they said, you know what, go home to your wife. Be with your wife. Now, you've been working hard. Be home with your wife. And it says he gives him a gift, and you know, my guess is that gift is like, you know, two bottles of Dom Perignon, you know, and some strawberries, some cheese, whatever. You know, send some gift home with him, thinking, you know, okay, go home, be with your wife. Verse 9, but Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to the house. When David was told Uriah did not go home, he asked him, haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah, they're staying in tents right now. And my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, king, I will not do such a thing. Wow. So he's saying, you know, all my other fellow soldiers are out there fighting. The ark of God is out there fighting. How could I go home and be with my wife? Which, of course, is this, whether he knows it or not, is a rebuke to David. That's exactly where David should be right now. And so David's plan fails. So he tries another plan. Verse 12. Then David said to him, stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, once again, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. So this time David gets him drunk to try to get him to go home, thinking if he's drunk, he'll do this, and he doesn't. And David must be thinking, how hard is it to get a guy to sleep with his own wife? Can't even get this guy to sleep with his own wife, something that was very easy for David to do. So he now devises a much more cunning and evil plot. As you know, verse 14, in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it he wrote, put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. So imagine that. David has his good friend, his trusted comrade, carry in his own hands his own death sentence with him back to battle. And of course, the plan depends on Uriah being a faithful soldier who's not going to look at whatever is written in this thing. And so David has this guy carry his own death sentence back with him into battle. And it gets to Joab, and I think that Joab sees sees David's plan and realizes this plan isn't going to work the way David wants it. I mean, if everybody, if you're fighting and all of a sudden everybody pulls back from Uriah all at the same time, it's going to be really obvious that there's a death sentence on this guy. We can't just do it that easily. So what he decides to do, as we'll read, is, well, I'm going to have to commit several different soldiers to go too far, and some of them are going to have to die to make this not look so obvious that we're trying to kill Uriah. So I think that's what Joab does with David's plot. All right, so I'm going to read verse 16 through 24 now. So, while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why did you get so close to the wall?' If he asks you this, then say to him, 'Also your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" The messenger set out, and when he arrived, he told David everything Joab had sent to say. The messenger said to David, "The men overpowered us and came out against us in the open, but we drove them back to the entrance to the city gate. Then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead." And listen to David's response. David told the messenger, "Say this to Joab, 'Don't let this upset you.'" Literally, "Don't let this be an evil in your eyes. The sword devours one as well as the other." That's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. "Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Joab." Wow. Verse 26, "When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son." And then we get, finally, something from the Lord here. This is the turning point in the story. "But the thing David had done displeased the Lord." There's an understatement. Literally, the thing he had done was evil in the Lord's eyes. Amazing set of circumstances from the great King David, a man after God's own heart. So, the turning point, as I said, is at the end of chapter 11. Chapter 12, God now sends Nathan to David. And as I see it, this is a really painful confrontation, but Nathan is God's gift to David. He's a picture of God's grace to David. And something that caught me this week as I was reading this that I hadn't thought of before, at least as I understand it, it looks like the child is born before Nathan comes to David, which means David had at least 9 months to sit on this before Nathan came to him. That's a long time to stew and to keep this whole thing under wraps. So the Lord sends Nathan to David. Finally, God does the sending this time. Verse 1, chapter 12. "The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, 'There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor.'" Okay, here's what I think Nathan is doing. David is king at the time, obviously. And as the king, he's the supreme judge in the land. And so one of the roles that the king would have would be to have people come to him and they would bring cases before him, you know, cases of injustice, something that's going on in his kingdom, and he would make a ruling on it. And that would be the law of the land. So Nathan comes to him and brings him what appears to be something that's happening in his kingdom right now, asking for the judgment of the king. Of course, it's a made-up story. But that's what Nathan's doing. So he says, "All right, king, I've got a case for you right now. There's something going on in your kingdom, and I need your ruling on it. What do you think?" And he tells him this story. There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. Verse 2, the rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little lamb he had bought, one little lamb. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, you know what he did? He took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. So Nathan tells a story, which, of course, completely parallels David's situation. Here's David, this rich man with everything he could possibly want, all the riches he wants, and many, many wives and concubines, and yet he takes from Uriah's one wife that is so precious to him. And what is David's response to hearing this story? Verse 5, David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." David responds with righteous, just anger. And maybe even he goes overboard. I mean, I'm not sure this guy actually deserves to die for stealing a lamb. There's nothing in the law that says he actually deserves to die. So maybe he even goes overboard. And Robert Alter, who is a Jewish scholar of a Jewish narrative, makes a really interesting point. He says, Nathan may be counting on the possibility that the obverse side of a guilty conscience in a man like David is the anxious desire to do the right thing. That part of a guilty conscience is this anxious desire to go and do the right thing in other ways. And he calls this David's compensatory zeal to do justice. David's compensating for a guilty conscience by giving this, you know, this just zeal in other areas of his life. And of course, you know, Nathan's strategy is brilliant here, right? Rather than just come out and condemn David and say you committed adultery and murder, he basically has David condemn himself, right? I mean, he sets David up. Charles Swindoll says this, "David has now stuck his whole head in the noose. All Nathan had to do was give it a little pull." And that's what he does with these four famous words, verse 7. Nathan turns to David and says, "You are the man. You are the man that I was just talking about." And in an instant, with those four words, you know, it all comes crashing down on David. And there's conviction. And he realizes that the cover-up it's blown. And the person who matters most, the God of the universe, knows what's been going on all these 9 months or however long this has been going on in David's life. Nathan goes on, "You are the man," to talk about the consequences of this sin. This is verse 7. "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more than this. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despise me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who's close to you, which will be his own son. And he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." So these devastating consequences of David's sin. And then let's look at David's response. This is the first good thing he's done so far today. "Then David said to Nathan, 'I have sinned against the Lord.'" This honest, brief confession, doesn't try to excuse it. Doesn't try to rationalize it, just says it, "I have sinned against the Lord." Maybe an understatement, but a true one. Listen to what he hears next. Verse 13, second half. "Nathan replied, 'The Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die.'" So he gets this immediate assurance of God's forgiveness. And then let me just read to you the rest of the story. Verse 15, I'll read through verse 25. "After Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted and went into his house and spent nights lying on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food with them. On the seventh day, the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they thought, 'While the child was still living, we spoke to David, but he would not listen to us. How can we tell him the child's dead? He might do something desperate.' David noticed that his servants were whispering among themselves, and he realized the child was dead." "Is the child dead?" he asked. "Yes," they replied. "He's dead." "Then David got up from the ground. After he had washed, put on lotions, and changed his clothes, he went into the house of the Lord and worshiped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request, they served him food, and he ate. His servants asked him, "Why are you acting this way? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but now that the child is dead, you get up and eat." He answered, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he's dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him," meaning I'll go to him in the grave eventually, "but he will not return to me." Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he went to her and lay with her. She gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon. The Lord loved him. And because the Lord loved him, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah, which means loved by the Lord. So there's the story. Very familiar. What I want to do is just step back from it and offer a couple key lessons, key perspectives. And today, my thoughts are about as basic as they come. In my mind, the realities of the story are about as basic as they come. Two fundamental realities, the tragedy and the reality of sin, and the wonder of God's grace. Okay? It's about as fundamental as they come, the tragic reality of sin and the wonder of God's grace. So let's spend some time thinking about sin this morning, okay? Not the funnest thing to do. But let's talk about, this morning I want to talk about the ABCs of sin, and I don't usually try to come up with clever, alliterations. That's probably why you come to this church, but I couldn't help myself. The ABCs of sin. I want to talk about the allure of sin, the blindness of sin, and the consequences of sin, okay? So let's talk about the allure of sin, the sheer power that sin can have on a person's life. And that, to me, is the first thing that strikes me about this story. How strong sin is that it can take someone down like this. And to me, it's just, how could this guy do these things? The sheer strength of sin that a guy like David could do things like this. I mean, this is God's anointed, right? This is the guy that God chose according to his own heart, has set his spirit in David. This is the guy that we've seen when Israel was afraid of Goliath. He looked at Goliath and said, "Who are you to defy the living God?" And he was filled with this righteous zeal for God's honor. This is the guy who we saw when he had opportunities to kill and take vengeance on Saul. He said, "Hey, I'm not gonna take vengeance. That's not mine. I'm not gonna take what's not mine." Okay? That's what he was saying, a couple chapters back. This is the guy who last week we looked at, he's dancing before the ark. He's so passionate about the presence of God. He says, "I want the presence of God right at the center of Israel's life." And yet you've got a guy like that doing these things, coveting, committing adultery, deceiving, lying, and ultimately murdering, premeditated murder of not one but multiple people, it turns out. And I think the lesson for us is just to be sobered by the power and reality of sin, to acknowledge that we're all capable of this. Tim Keller says that the seeds of this sin is in every one of us. And given the right circumstances, that those seeds could blossom and flower and become these full-fledged sins. And as I thought about it, I think that's really important to acknowledge as a group of people, especially if you're like me, if you're one of those conscientious rule followers, kind of the moral neurotics, basically, and you're good at doing good. And especially for people like that, we need to acknowledge, this could be me. There before the grace of God, this could be me. And honestly, if you just came up to me and said, "Are you capable of premeditated murder on one of your good friends?" I honestly go, "I don't think I am." And this story says, think again. Because here's the reality. Here's a guy who's way more spiritual than I'll ever be, a guy who's way more passionate about God than I ever will be, a guy who has way more character than I do, certainly way more courage than I ever did, and he's doing these things. If he can do these things, of course I can do them too. And so I think one of the lessons is just the allure, the sheer power of sin. And that should lead us to a humility, and we'll come back to that at the end. All right, so that's the allure. The one that really caught me this week is number 2B, the blindness. The blindness of sin. And I want to talk about that in two ways. First thing sin does, sin totally blinds us to the road that it's taking us down, okay? where this road is leading, sin totally blinds us. And certainly that was the case for David here. I mean, you look at this, he didn't know where this was headed. And you really see the gradual progression of sin in this story. It starts kind of subtle. David should be out in battle, but he's not, right? He's back home. That leads him to taking extra long naps, which leads him to going outside and seeing this woman, which leads him to lust after her, which leads him to commit adultery with her, which leads him to try to cover it up, bring his friend home, which leads him to murdering his friend on the battlefield, which leads to multiple murders on the battlefield, okay? There's this progression. To me, that's one of the tragic things, is you see David just get deeper and deeper and deeper as he tries to cover up and make up for it, and you know, just this mess that he ends up with in the end. And the reality is, he was totally blind to where this was going. If someone came to him that day and said, hey, you know what the end of this road is? Is multiple murders of some of your key soldiers. I can almost guarantee you he wouldn't have done it. Right? But he was blind to it. And that's what sin does. That's what temptation does. It blinds us to where it's taking us. Of course, that's what it does. All we see is the moment, what we're tempted to do in the moment. I mean, you take this sin of adultery, you know. I mean, of course, that's how temptation works. When you see that good-looking coworker, you know, or that good-looking person at the restaurant, whatever, of course, all temptation is doing is showing us what a night with that person would be like. Right? Of course, temptation doesn't give you the picture of you sitting at the kitchen table with your kids explaining why you and your spouse are separating, right? Of course, temptation never does that. It blinds us to the road that it's taking us down. It's the blindness of sin. And then the other thing I think that it blinded David to and blinds us to is it even blinds us to the wrongness of the sin itself, even the evil nature of the sin itself. And what I'm referring to is our remarkable ability to rationalize and to justify and to spin things a certain way so that the thing we're tempted to do doesn't seem as bad as it actually is. And, you know, we don't get insight into David's own rationalization here, but I can imagine a bunch of different rationalizations in his mind. Okay, you've got this guy. He's king of the world, basically. And I think this is especially tempting for people in power. In extreme leadership positions, it would have been easy for him to say, I've been so successful, I am so well loved, I've been doing everything right, I am God's man, and to have this sense of invincibility about him, thinking, you know, I can kind of do whatever I want, whatever I lay my eyes on, I can have. Or maybe the rationalization went the other way. Maybe it was all the pressures that he had in leadership that no one else understood. The loneliness of leadership and thinking, you know, I have sacrificed so much for the greater good. I'm always thinking about the nation, what the nation needs, how to protect it, how to meet its needs. And I've been doing that. Nobody else understands what that's like, to constantly think about the nation. You know what? I am ready for some me time. I am ready to meet my own needs. And I deserve that. I mean, no one else has the kind of responsibility I do. I'm ready to meet my own needs. And I can see that kind of rationalization going on in his head. And of course, the cover-up would have been really easy to rationalize, right? I mean, I'm the nation's leader. The nation cannot know about this. It would not be good for the nation if they knew about this, right? If they found out their leader, who is supposed to be a picture of morality and purity, it would be bad for everybody if this came out. That's really easy to rationalize. And it's stunning to me, the blindness of sin in this passage. And Nathan comes to him and gives him a story that's exactly like his story. And David is filled with righteous zeal. He says, that is wrong, and that man deserves to die. He sees sin, he just doesn't see it in himself, right? He just can't see it in his own life. He doesn't make the connection. And so Nathan has to make the connection for him. So there's the blindness of sin. It blinds us to the road it's taking us down, and it even blinds us to the wrongness of the sin. And then finally, of course, and most painfully, we see the consequences of sin, which are nothing short of devastating in this passage. You see that God's grace and his forgiveness, in the midst of that, it doesn't mean that David is freed from some of the consequences of his sin. And this really is the turning point in David's career and his legacy. And those of you who know the rest of the story, the rest of 2 Samuel is a sad story where David has to live out the consequences of his sin. And, you know, just briefly, you know, God's consequences here are very just. You know, you look back at verses 9 through 12, and God basically says this, all right? You struck down Uriah by the sword, so the sword is not going to depart from your house. And you took another man's wife, so someone's going to take your wives. It's a very just crime where God is basically saying, David, I'm going to give you what you want. You want adultery? You want violence? You can have it. And you're going to get it. And you're going to get it full-fledged, and that's going to be the consequence of your sins. So that's the first reality, the tragic reality of human sin. But of course, what we also see in this passage is the wonder of God's grace. And I want to just mention three ways that I see God's grace playing out in this story. First, God sending Nathan to David is an act of grace. Then, of course, most importantly, his forgiveness of David is an act of grace. And then also his restoring David to life and freedom and joy is an act of grace. So let's look at those real quickly. Think about David, or God sending Nathan. Have you ever thought about that as an act of grace on God's part? You know, it's a very painful confrontation that takes place. But it was helpful for me to ask myself this week, and I encourage you to ask yourself this. What was God's goal in this confrontation? What was his heart for this confrontation for David? It was restoration. It was reconciliation. It was forgiveness. And so him sending Nathan is God pursuing David, going out and running after David and bringing him back when David, for 9+ months, was hell-bent on going his own way and covering this up. And even the way he goes about it, I think, is gracious. Nathan goes about it in a way that disarms David, right? He doesn't just come to him and say, hey, you committed adultery and murder, which I imagine would have raised all of David's defenses, and a guy with power and defenses is a dangerous man. Instead, he goes around David's defenses, and he disarms him, and he gets David to condemn himself in the midst of it, which ultimately leads to bringing down those defenses so that David can be in a place where he's able to confess and repent and acknowledge the sin. And so I see this picture of God sending David, Nathan, this picture of a God who pursues us, who reaches out even in the midst when we're trying to hide from him, cover up, run from him. He comes, and his confrontations with us, we don't have to be afraid of them ultimately, because his goal is always that restoration of peace with him, of reconciliation. So that's first. Most importantly, God's grace comes in God's forgiveness of David, that God frees David from the ultimate consequences of his sin, even though he's going to have to experience some temporal consequences. And this struck me this week. You look at verse 13, take a look at it one more time. This is the first thing that David has said. This is the first time David has acknowledged his sin. Verse 13, David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. What's the first thing that David hears upon acknowledging his sin? Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. Just like that, David acknowledges his sin and he hears, God's taken it away. You're not going to die. You're not going to experience the ultimate consequences. There's going to be a lot of temporal consequences. But the first words are words of forgiveness. And that is our God. God is so quick to forgive. And David doesn't even know what we know. David doesn't know why God forgives him. He knows that God is forgiving, but we know so much more, that God chooses to forgive David, and David doesn't have to experience the eternal consequences of his sin, because God is going to send a son of David, Jesus Christ, who is going to pay the penalties for his sins. And that's why God, 1,000 years earlier, can forgive David, because he is going to judge that sin on the cross 1,000 years later. And that's what Romans 3 says, is that God in his forbearance left those previous sins unpunished because he laid those sins on Jesus Christ on the cross. And so we know more than David does of why God can just forgive him just like that. So we see his grace in sending Nathan, and of course, most importantly, in forgiving him. And then something that struck me is God doesn't just forgive David and forgive the eternal consequences, but God also restores David to a level of peace and joy and freedom in his life. And that's what you see, I think, in the end of this story. The child gets sick, and David is mourning and pleading and begging, and then the child dies, and then David makes this change and says, okay, that's one of the consequences, and this is the new life that I have. And he stops mourning, and he stops fasting, and he even says, even goes in and he worships God. And he eats, and he starts life again. And I think he's restored to, certainly, there's going to be a lot of brokenness, but there's going to be a level of peace and even joy in the midst of that. And again, what I said earlier, what struck me is the 9-plus months that David lived with this sin and tried to cover it up. I wonder how brutal those months were for him, trying deep down to keep this from God and having to live with this cover-up and live with the guilt and the imprisonment of that sin. David, in Psalm 32, he describes a time in his life, and it doesn't say it's necessarily this, but I'll bet it was, when he kept a sin before God, when he didn't acknowledge a sin to God. And this is how he describes it. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. This guy who is just riddled with guilt and the weight of a guilty conscience. And so I think part of God's grace was to bring him to a level of freedom again, where everything's out on the table with God, and where there's brokenness, but there can be joy and freedom again, which is ultimately way better than what he had before. So that's what I see, the tragic reality of sin and the wonder of God's grace. So I want to leave you with two things today. And it's this, maybe you need to be reminded of the tragic reality of sin, or maybe you need to be reminded of God's grace. And if you're in that first camp, maybe you just need to be reminded of the sheer power and reality of sin. And I want to offer you two strategies for sin. They're real simple, nothing new. What I see in this passage, first strategy, what do you do with sin? You just run, right? You just run. You flee, you don't think about it, you just kill it before it starts killing. You cut it off as quickly as you can. What I think we should have in light of this passage is this utter humility and soberness before the strength of sin. And I look around, you know, culturally, and we're living in a culture where even as Christians, we have this tendency to treat sin real lightly, right? Sin's not that big of a deal. It's something that we just allow to kind of run around in our lives. C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce has this great picture of a person who has this this little lizard on their shoulder that kind of whispers things, they kind of keep with them. And to me, it's this picture of sin, like this little pet. And I think that's what our culture does with sin. We carry it around like this little pet, and we coddle it sometimes, and we pet it, and we feed it a little bit. We never give it free rein. You know, we never just kind of let it loose, but we kind of keep it there and play with it. And this is one of those passages where you go, you know what, just kill that thing. Don't keep it around, just run from it. Run before you have the ability to start rationalizing why this is going to be a good thing or this is going to be an okay thing. And that's certainly what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, right? He says, you know what, if your right eye is causing you to sin, just gouge it out. If your right hand is causing you to sin, cut it off. And what he's saying is, you know, just catch it quick. Don't think about it, just flee, just get away from it. Easier said than done, right? But that's certainly what this passage encourages us to. And the other strategy, I think, is this. We need Nathans in our lives, right? We can't do this life by ourselves. We're not going to overcome sin by ourselves. We need community. We need those, you know, one or two or three trusted friends that we can give very explicit freedom to communicate truth to us. People who we say, hey, we're living life together. I'm giving you explicit permission to speak truth into my life. When I'm going off somewhere, for you to say, hey, dude, what are you doing? And for me to have that permission in your life and to have the courage to care for you enough to say, hey, this is what I'm seeing. I might be wrong, but this is what I'm seeing in your life. We need to be Nathans, and we need Nathans. And of course, you have to do this with people you really trust. You can't just go out and be Nathans to everybody. That's not going to work too well. Well, you can try it, but I don't encourage it. But one or two or three trusted friends. Hebrews 3:13 says this, encourage one another daily so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. We don't want to become hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. And so what we need to be doing is encouraging one another, speaking truth into each other's lives. And we talked about the blindness of sin. We all have our blind spots, right? There's all things, we all have these parts of us that we just don't see, that if you asked a person in 5 minutes, they could tell you some things about yourself that you didn't fully realize. And so we need one another to cover our blind spots. And I heard someone compare it to, it's kind of like when you're with your spouse and you're at a dinner and you know, your spouse, maybe your wife looks over at you and says, you know, do I have anything in my teeth real quick? Anything there? You know, she can't see it. Do I have anything in my teeth? That's kind of what we need to do with one another. Do I have anything in my teeth? I can't see it. Tell me. Or maybe even say, hey, here are the ways that I tend to go wrong. So let me just tell you, these are my, kind of, this is where I tend to go. So you watch out for those things in my life. And let me know when you see it. Because on my own, I don't know if I'm going to do this well. So first, maybe you need to be reminded of the reality of sin. And then finally, maybe you need to be reminded this morning of the wonder of God's grace. Maybe some of you this morning are living with a deep level of guilt and shame in your lives. And you've been hiding something from God. You've been, you know, just going at something that isn't good, and you are feeling the weight of that, and you're feeling that God's hand is heavy upon you. And I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but I want just to be able to speak this so that you hear it from somebody else, and you're reminded that it really doesn't matter what you've done. It really doesn't matter what you've done. God's grace is there for you. And God forgives us. And there is no sin. There is nothing that you have done that's beyond God's forgiveness, even if it feels like there's nothing. I can almost guarantee you probably haven't done worse than David. Probably haven't done multiple murders, okay? Whatever it is, it's not worse than this guy who God forgave. And so there's nothing we can do that's outside of the realm of God's forgiveness. And so I want to encourage you today, if you're in that place, stop running, stop hiding, stop trying to cover it up, and just acknowledge it to God. Confess it to him. Openly say, God, you already know this. I already know this. So let's just be open. I'm going to acknowledge to you this is what's been going on. And don't try to rationalize it. Don't try to justify it. Don't try to say, you know what, I promise I'm going to get better. I'm going to make up for it. Don't do any of that. Just a clean acknowledgement. This is what I've done. I've sinned in your eyes. I've done something that is evil in your eyes. And then trust. Just trust in the forgiveness that you have in God. Trust that you're forgiven. And trust that you're forgiven not just because God is a gracious, forgiving guy, which he is, but trust that you're forgiven because that sin, whatever it is, has already been judged on the cross. God has already judged that sin, and he's not going to judge it twice. It would be unjust for him to judge it a second time. It's already taken care of on the cross. Trust Jesus' words when he says it's finished on the cross. It is finished. And when Paul says there's no condemnation, there is no condemnation. God is for you now. God is not against you. There's nothing that can separate you from the love of God in Jesus Christ. Trust that this morning. Let's pray. Father, this week I am grateful that your word does not idolize its heroes. It doesn't paint a false picture of the heroes of faith, but it paints a realistic picture of the brokenness of every one of your servants. And thank you that we have examples, countless in the Bible, people who are as broken as we are, and yet people who you used in such incredible ways to show that the light doesn't come through them, but it doesn't come from them, but it comes from you. And so I pray for people here today in this body who are toying with certain sins, that you would convict us, convict our hearts to just flee, to talk to somebody, to get away from that, to not compromise, but to recognize the seriousness of it, the consequences of it, and to seek righteousness and holiness and goodness and wholeness. And I pray for those here that are wrestling with guilt and shame and self-hatred, that your forgiveness, which they already have, that you would make it more real to them today. That your spirit would just bring that truth alive into their hearts. That they would know and even feel in their bones that there really is no condemnation. That you have forgiven them, not because they're going to be better, but because of your son. We want to be a people who pursue holiness and who also live in the freedom of your grace. Help us do that this week. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen.